Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Digital Audio Health by Cymatrax.
Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show with your host, Rhonda Grant. If you believe that there is more to life than what you see right now, and you want to find out more, listen in as her guests share their journey and their extraordinary experiences. Now, here is your host, Rhonda Grant.
Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show. Sometimes the universe has a way of placing people or obstacles in your path to help guide and direct you on your mission. Listen in as we discover the path my guest has traveled. Has he been inspired by a calling, crafted his journey, or a bit of both? I invite you to embrace the conversation and to use it to help you to recognize if this is happening in your life. Our guest today is Hi Conrad, who is a best-selling author and television writer. Hi has made a career out of murder, earning the Independent Press Award for Best Mystery, the NYC Big Book Award for Best Mystery Series, a Scribe Award for Best Novel, and garnering 3 Edgar nominations from the Mystery Writers of America. Along the way, he developed a hoard of popular games and interactive films, hundreds of short stories, and a dozen books of solvable mysteries, published in over 15 languages. Hi is best known for 8 seasons as writer, co-executive producer for the groundbreaking TV series Monk. Other shows include White Collar and The Good Cop. Welcome to the Rhonda Grant Show, Hi.
Hello, Rhonda. It's great to meet you.
Yes, it's great to meet you too. You know, a lot of people wonder how writers began writing, who encouraged them. And how old were you when you started writing?
I think I've always had a bit of a storyteller in me. I actually began working professionally when I was 14 as an actor, as a stage actor. And I basically took a train up to New York City, skipped school for a day, and auditioned for a show. And they said, come back with a guardian. And my mother came back with me the next time. And I toured the country doing the first national tour of Oliver and played one of the one of Fagin's boys. So I actually was acting until I was in my late 20s. But always, I think, had a storytelling spirit. And then at that point, I was doing summer stock in Pennsylvania, and I wrote, came up with the idea for a musical. I was foolish enough to write the book, music, and lyrics, which is, you know, a big, big job. And it ran off Broadway for a little while, but I made some connections there, and enough people liked it, and enough people liked me, that began my career as a writer. So, you know, I guess I didn't come into writing until a little bit later, although my mother said that she always knew that I would be a writer. I guess there was something about the way my mind worked that she thought it would work well being a writer.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that if you're an artist, you're an artist? Like, a lot of artists are multi-talented.
You know, I've always loved theater, and it wasn't until I got into writing, though, that I got, I could make a living as a stage actor between gigs in New York and, you know, road companies and summer stock. But I never really took the big step into something that could really pay the bills and get my name out there until I turn to writing. But I do think that there is a creative, I think everybody has a creative force, but some people just nurture it, or it gets nurtured, or it's something that they really love doing. I mean, I have a lot of friends who can't imagine being a writer and sitting by yourself for hours every day and trying to second guess yourself all the time. But that's, what I've been doing for a long time now.
Yes, you said something interesting there, is writing and sitting alone by yourself with your computer. And well, in the beginning, we're writing on paper.
I was using a chisel and a block of stuff. But yeah, it later became a typewriter.
It later became a typewriter, yes. Mm-hmm. So with the process, okay, so are you a disciplined writer? Do you get up every day and write, or do you write certain days for certain amount of hours, or do you?
I get up every morning when I'm not on vacation or the day isn't full of other activities,
right,
which is almost all the time. I sit down, usually by 9 o'clock and work a couple hours in the morning and then a couple hours in the afternoon. And it's just what I do. And if I'm between projects, then I will come up with something to fill in that time. Writing is what I do. I get fulfillment from it. Even if projects get canceled or, certain books don't sell as well, I get great pleasure out of the process. So, it's what I do.
Mm-hmm. I love the process of writing. I love the creativity and the ideas that come to you. And just when you think, some people say they have writer's block. Have you had writer's block? And if you have, how did you?
I think writer's block comes from not being prepared for the next step in the process. Which doesn't mean it's any less of a block. When that occurs, then I know that, okay, I'm not prepared. I don't know what my hero, what he's doing next, or I haven't figured out this part of the story, or I haven't figured out this part of the emotional journey. And so if I concentrate on that for a day or so, usually I can overcome a writer's block. One phrase that I use and other people use is having a story with good bones. Okay. If you have a story with a good structure, if you have with good bones, then that will, you can work within that. You can change this aspect and that aspect, but as long as the bones are all in place, then you can adapt and make it work. If you have like a faulty concept or a character that doesn't work, then it's a lot harder. But if the bones are there, then and you give it thought and you do your research and, you get up in the middle of the night and write notes to yourself, then usually it can work and you can get through writer's block as long as the structure is there. And sometimes it's not there. Sometimes you just have to say, this is a failed concept and I'm going to move on to something else.
Yeah, and maybe pick it back up another time. But, you said something interesting there, in the middle of the night, writing it down, because when you get those ideas in the middle of the night, they're gone in the morning unless you record them.
Yeah, and then you're so anxious about remembering the next morning be sure to remember that. It's just easier to have a notepad either in your bathroom or beside your bed to jot it down.
Very good advice. Very good advice. And I have one of those, because you just never know. You could be just almost going to sleep in that hypnagogic state, and you start, you know, they have to wake your, you know, wake yourself up a little bit to write. Do you ever dream that about a character that it fills in the character for you?
No, I don't think I've ever had that experience. You know, I will often, as I said, as you're nodding off, think, oh, maybe she didn't cover this, or maybe I need to go back and redo a scene to make sure that the viewer knows this or the reader knows that. But I have enough weird dreams that I don't need to impose them on my characters.
Yeah. Sometimes I dream words, and there are really neat sentences that I don't want to forget, and I'll write that down. Hmm. Do you have a favorite book or series that you've written?
It's always the one that you're working on now.
Yes. So
the work I'm doing, the Callie McPhee Mysteries.
And, yes.
And they're set in Austin, Texas.
Nice.
And I wrote two of them before I ever visited Austin, Texas, which is the wonder of Google and the wonder of having an editor. My editor is from, spent a lot of time in Austin. But we visited it for South by Southwest, which is a marvelous festival. We'll probably go back again this year or next year to the festival. So the Callie McPhee Mysteries, I think, are really great. They're kind of old school Texas versus kind of the new ethos. And the idea is this investigative reporter comes back home to try to make up with her father. She gets a job in Austin. And her father is, like, for decades has been the most important fixer in the state. You know, he was Secretary of State. He had all sorts of different offices in Texas. And he was the go-to guy to get problems solved. And now, very secretly, she finds out that he is beginning to develop dementia. And so all these secrets that are in his brain from 20 years ago could spill out at any time. So he needs to keep this a secret. Meanwhile, she's trying to undo some of the damage that he might have done in cases that he's, like, half forgotten.
Right.
And so that's kind of the structure, the bones of the Callie McPhee Mysteries. And, you know, her father plays a major, major role in the first book and a slightly smaller role in book two and in book three, which I'm about halfway through writing.
Yes.
He is more of a tangential character, and she kind of takes center stage. You know, I don't want to use his dementia for... I want to treat it seriously. There's a lot of humor in the book, but you want to treat it realistically. He will have less of his mental capabilities as the series progresses. And then at some point, if the series goes on long enough, he will probably die, and she will kind of take over the whole central core of the series.
Yes.
But it's now her and her father, and then, you know, the other people who work with them.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. A beautiful concept.
Well, when I was working on the series Monk, some writer, I'm not sure it was me or someone else in the room,
yes,
wouldn't it be interesting if you had someone who had, like, all these secrets and then started to develop dementia? And so he would be a real threat to, you know, all the suspects, because he knew their secrets and his mind was going, and he could blurt them out at any time.
Right.
And so, and that never worked into a Monk episode because it was a little too dark.
Okay.
Because Monk is a very light show.
It is, yes.
And so it was, like, an idea that was always in the back of my mind. And, you know, I started in Texas where there are a lot of, you know, a lot of politicking go on. It could have been, New York, but I didn't want other like major industries around. Like if it was set in LA, then film might be in there. If it was set in New York City, then you have all sorts of industries. And I wanted it sort of an isolated venue. And I thought Texas is sort of a world to itself. So that's why I set it in a place I'd never been.
Yes. Now, do you generally travel to places to be inspired with the book that you're writing?
Well, I wrote an earlier series about a travel agent, someone who goes, who takes people on exotic vacations, and then, you know, murder always happens. And I've been to all those locations, and, you know, we love to travel. We travel a lot. Like the week before COVID, we were in Indonesia, and as soon as it lifted, we went to other places. So that's a big part of my life, traveling and discovering new places, not in tour groups. Like in a week or so, we're going to Australia and we're getting a 4x4, like a Land Cruiser, and driving across like the top part of Australia, going into the Red Center and, you know, places where mostly just Australians go, not a lot of American tourists. Yes. And so you can think of yourself as an explorer somehow, even though you are just a tourist, but you can, you know, make believe that you're kind of discovering things.
Yeah, sure. So when you travel and go to different places, do you set time aside to write, or do you bring a recorder with you? Like, how do
I don't write. I don't write on trips. We did spend 5 months in New Zealand, and right as we were leaving, I got a book contract, but it was a shortish book, and we were there for 5 months. So I would, you know, get up and every other day or so and write a bit of that book and dot it in by the deadline. So it was fine. But usually, as a rule, you know, you spend all this money and make all these plans to, you know, go to great places. And, you know, when we travel, it's not a writer's retreat. It's, mm-hmm. you know, we're up every day and out seeing things and hiking. And I put writing aside when I travel.
Mm-hmm. Well, and, you know, your brain needs the break. And it revitalizes you as well. And so that when you get back to the computer, you're like brand new, right? You have new ideas and.
Maybe, but I, you know, there are only a few things I love, and, you know, writing I love, and traveling I love.
Yes.
And when, you know, if just sitting in the same place, doing the same thing day after day, month after month, you know, it gets boring. So breaking it up with, I guess you're right. You do sort of feel revitalized. It's not as though you're doing the same thing every day for, you know, 6 months in a row.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've done a lot of writing when I've been away, and I lost something really valuable. When I was 34, I flew fixed wing over the Grand Canyon, terrified. I had claustrophobia and they put me in the seat at the back. I was one of the people that, you know, clapped when we landed, and we saw the other planes and they just looked like bees, you know, when you're up in the air like that. Mm-hmm. But I was flying over the Grand Canyon. I was looking at all the layers of evolution, and all of a sudden, all this information was coming to me. And I wasn't a writer at the time. I wrote letters to people, but I wasn't a writer, so I didn't have anything to record it, didn't have a pen and paper and things like that. And by the time we got back to the hotel, of course, it was gone, and I have no idea, but it was amazing what was coming into my brain.
It sounds like an acid trip. It sounds like you were on an acid trip.
Well, No, it wasn't an acid trip for sure. I've never taken acid, but, you know, I always, you know, think about that because there are energy vortexes in the world where, and that's one of the energy vortexes is over the Grand Canyon, that you can actually experience these types of things. And, but most often, my brain just creates, and I just have learned to keep something with me, like a little, just a little tiny book to carry around. And just if I can, like, just write a few things down, I'll be able to reconstruct it when I get back to my computer. I love talking to you and the process that you go through. I'm just amazed by it because, you know, I do different things and my vacation is writing. So when I wake up on a Saturday morning or anything like that, and I'm just like, I'm going to write today. But I find that I do my best writing on a deadline, you know, a chapter four book or, you know, something like that, then I do my best writing at that time, because it forces me to ignite my craft and to just sit in really. I mean, do you feel that you've been, I'm going to kind of reverse this a little bit. Do you feel that you've been called to do this, or do you feel that you've crafted it, or a bit of both?
I remember being very young and going to movies and coming home. And I guess a lot of kids are like this. And you tell the plot to your parents or to whomever. But I was always very focused on what I thought was a good story. And I would, you know, tell it over and over again. Yeah, this happened in the movie and then that happened. And he didn't know it, but this was really going on behind him. And so I think, looking back, that I was always wanted to tell stories. And I think as part of my legacy, I'm going to be leaving some money to literary seminar that will have some classes and some lectures focused on the art of storytelling and how to tell a good story.
Yes. Yes. I mean, and that's how humans have evolved is through storytelling.
Yeah. The name Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey, historians now concur that there was no person named Homer, that these stories evolved as poems, and poems are much easier to memorize than prose because of the meter. I'm not sure they had rhyme back at that point, but the meter and the structure of poetry made it easier to memorize. So over perhaps hundreds or a thousand years, the story of the Odyssey, the story of the Iliad and the, you know, Fall of Troy, became these lengthy poems passed on from one entertainer or one person to another, and they would embellish them. And then at some point, the Greeks wrote them down and put the name Homer on them. So, you know, when you read the Iliad, you are reading something that generations and generations of people created. And that's kind of magical.
It's very magical. Well, and I think the whole thing is magical. I think that writing is magical, and poems and all of those things. I mean, I just love reading all of those things. You're listening to The Rhonda Grant Show right now, whose podcast has been treated with digital audio health by my sponsor, Simatrex. And today we are speaking with Hi Conrad. How may people reach out to you if they wanted to find out more and more about the books that you write?
I do have a website. It's HiConrad.com, which is easy to remember, one hopes. And then I have I have a Facebook group as well, but the easiest way to find out what I've done and what I'm doing currently is to go to highconrad.com.
Wonderful. What is the favorite piece that you have written?
A book? You know, a lot of stuff that one writes is successful. Some of it is not successful. Yes. Some never sees the light of day, but you still think it's great. You know, there have been times in which I've pitched a series to a network, and they will pay me to write a draft of it. And then if they like the draft enough, then they will film it, film the pilot.
Yes.
So there have been one or two cases in which I've written something. Steve Martin and I wrote a pilot together many years ago. It was a mystery. And this was obviously years before he wrote Only Murders in the Building.
Yes.
But it was kind of a light mystery. And it was called Mr. and Mr. North. I think that was, or Mr. and Mr. Nash. And the idea was that we these two gay interior decorators who were a couple, and they would go. And so they knew all the houses of these rich people in New York. And when a murder occurred, they knew enough about these homes and about the interior design, about, oh, someone replaced this carpet, you can tell.
Oh, yes.
That they would figure out the murder. And so we wrote a pilot for ABC, and we loved it, but ABC passed on it, and it never got filmed. Alan Cumming was set to be one of the leads. So, you know, projects like that are often my favorite, because you have this image of them in your mind about how, if it was perfectly crafted, if it was perfectly, done by the actors, that, it feels like a lost opportunity when it doesn't happen.
Yes. And did you pitch to a different network or?
No, I think at that point, because they paid us to write the pilot.
Oh, right.
It was their property.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, yeah, it never went on from there. And, these things happen, and they, now we're in the midst of a writer's strike. And that's even more upheaval.
Mm-hmm. And have you experienced a writer's strike before?
Yeah, in 2007, we were working on Monk. And
yes.
I actually lost a series of my own due to the writer's strike. I had pitched and sold a series. They were very excited about it. The network, I won't mention which network.
Mm-hmm.
The writer's strike lasted almost 4 months. And, a week before the strike, or a week or two before the strike, the network cut off communication. I didn't hear from them. We were, I had already been released from my Monk contract. So we were all poised. They cut off communication. 4 months later, my agent goes back to them, and they said, we're kind of changing direction here at the network, and we're not sure we want to do the show anymore. But a strike does cost you things, and it's not just, people lose work. I mean, I didn't lose any work on Monk because we came right back after 4 months, and we went back to work, and we made up for lost time. But, people do lose out because they're standing up for these, for what they think they deserve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there any thing that you're particularly proud of that you've worked on that didn't come to fruition?
Well, I mean, there's a series I did with, with Steve Martin, and then mm-hmm. there are always other ones. I have a couple projects that my agent is now selling, but of course that has all been cut off because agents can't talk to producers anymore. I mean,
right.
all communication is cut off during a strike. You can't send anyone a script. It's all cut off. And so there are a couple of things that I'm working on that I've finished. I wrote a rom-com, which has gotten some interest, but we can't communicate with anyone right now about it. I'm very proud of Monk. Obviously,
yes,
I was there from the very beginning.
Yeah.
What had happened was Andy Breckman, who's still a great friend, wrote Monk. They took a lot of time to find Tony Shalhoub and make sure he was right for the role. And it was an involved process. And then the studio says, this is great. All right, we're going to do it. You need 15 more episodes for the season. And Andy was a comedy writer. He was not a mystery writer. So he kind of panicked. He went to a bookstore. He found my books. He tracked me down, called me up.
Yes.
And basically said, I love your stories, and either I'm going to steal them or you're going to come work for me. And
so what did you say?
I said, I'll come work for you.
Yes.
And so I was probably the second person he hired. He hired his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Then he hired me, and then he hired someone else that he knew in the New York area. And we sort of became the core team and did it for 8 seasons. And all the actors brought so much wonderful stuff to it.
Yes.
And right now in Toronto, they are filming the Monk movie.
Okay.
There's a movie. I guess I can reveal the name. It's called Mr. Monk's Last Case.
Yes.
It's being filmed right now in Toronto. So, and I did some little consulting on that, and it's a great script. And Tony Shalhoub's there, and Jason and Trailer and Ted Levine are all up there, so they have the old team together again.
Awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah, what a great project to be part of.
Yeah, and so as far as like career moments, I think that was probably a real, real highlight. I'm so glad that he went to the bookstore and liked my stuff and tracked me down. That was all very lucky.
Yeah, well, right there, that's a great story. That he actually did that. And that's how he found you, and you were so thrilled, and you're available to work on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, originally I came on as a consultant, as a story consultant, and then every year I would get a promotion or two. And for the last couple of seasons, I was the co-executive producer, and then we went on to do a webisode series of Little Monk, which I was the executive producer on. It was really a very fast learning experience, learning how to write for TV, because I had never done it before.
Wow, it just seems like it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity that you realize that it was going to be important.
Yeah. He had the pilot already done. And I went to New York to meet with him, because I didn't live in New York at the time. I went to meet with him, and he showed me like the first 5 minutes of it. And at one point, I guess I kind of made a face, and then he stops the tape.
Yes.
And says, what? What?
Yeah. What kind of face?
And it was just kind of. Okay. Face. Yeah. And he said, you have a better clue here, don't you? You have a better clue in mind. And I said, yeah. This, I think, would have been a more clever clue.
And yes.
He said, damn, I should have done that. Damn, you're right. And I think that kind of sealed the deal that he knew I was the right person to hire.
Yes. I love that. And I love being with musicians that take that command too and say, no, that's not it. It's this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you really commanded the authority because what your input was made a difference. And
yeah.
If you can just make that difference in a short period of time, well, look what you did with it. I mean, I loved it. I watched a couple of the seasons. I really liked it.
Yeah, it was, we still have a big fan base. And, I still get nice residual checks from every place that it's being shown around the world. And there's, as far as I know, these things change. But as far as I know, I will be the representative, the consultant, when they do a version of, they're redoing all the Monk TV shows in India for a Hindi audience.
Right, and, okay.
I will be going over, the plan is for me to go over to Bollywood and to be on set when they film Monk in Hindi. So Monk is still, captivating audiences. And, and it's been done in Turkey. They did the same thing in Turkey. I was not part of that production. And now they're doing it in India. And I love India. We've been there several times. So,
have you?
Excuse me?
Oh, you have been to India several times?
Yeah, we have. And we absolutely love it. It's a wonderful country. The people are terrific. So it would be great to do it. And to do it not as a tourist, but to do it as part of like a working Bollywood set, I think would be really interesting.
Mm-hmm. I was going to ask you if it was in different languages. And
it's funny because it's often done with subtitles.
Yes.
Remember one time, and sometimes it's done in they dub it. I know in France they dub it, in Germany they dub it. I was once on, this is going to sound weird. I was once on a little boat, maybe 10 people, on the Amazon River in Peru. And you would pass by these shacks, and people had electricity. People had, satellites.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Tony Shalhoub and Ted Levine talking, and someone had in a little shack along the Amazon River had tuned in an episode of Monk. And I came back and told everyone that I heard them in the middle of the Amazon rainforest. And it's popular all over.
Wow, that must be an incredible feeling that your work is that far-reaching.
Every now and then I'll meet someone and I'll tell them what I do and what I've done, and they say, "Oh, you're famous." And I say, "No, I've worked on things that have become famous." It's not. Especially in TV, there's so many people. If we had anyone other than Tony Shalhoub doing that role, it would not have been successful. And, another actor was actually hired before Tony.
Uh-huh.
They did a little bit of filming, and then they realized that he wasn't the right choice. And then they waited out until Tony was available. There are many ways in which the show could not have worked. The original idea was a more serious idea. The original idea was, there was a Jack Nicholson character from As Good As It Gets.
Yes.
Who had OCD and was, I think, a novelist or is hard to get along with, and a real curmudgeon with OCD. And someone in LA walked out of the theater and said, "What if this guy was a cop? Would that be a good thing?" And so he wound up taking the idea to Andy Brickman, and Andy worked his magic on it. And I think with any other writer, it would have been a darker idea.
Okay. It
would, the character would not have been as sympathetic. There would not have been the humor, you know, because I mean, there is humor in As Good As It Gets, but it's much more character driven.
Yes.
And you know, so all these things made it a hit. And my contribution, I'm very much into plot structure, and to make a, you know, everyone remembers the comedy moments from Monk, but what held all the comedy moments together was the plot structure.
Yes.
And the we were very proud that there would be no drop-off during an episode. You know, the networks can tell when people change their channel halfway through or turn off the TV halfway through. And the only episode that we ever did that had a little bit of a drop-off was one, the only episode we wrote that didn't have a murder in it.
Oh.
It had, there was a missing chair, and someone was kidnapped, and but there was no murder, and we kind of learned our lesson that, okay, not only do you have to have a strong plot, but you have to have some stakes. You have to have something that's really at stake in it. And so we included murders from then on. And so that kind of what gives importance to a story, what makes a person scratch his head. You know, if you have one of our plots is we had someone on death row. He was going to be executed in half an hour, in an hour. Mm-hmm. He's given his last meal, and his last meal is poisoned. So who would poison someone who's just about to be executed?
I don't know. Who would?
See? And
I want to know.
And well, that was what we were given, you know.
Yeah.
How do you do this? And we came up with like three or four plausible plots. We assigned it to a writer who was a guest writer. She came in for a week, and we talked through the outline with her. She went home and she wrote it. She turned it back in, and we said, you know, there's probably a better story here. This doesn't quite hold together. Mm-hmm. And so the rest of the team actually wrote the episode. It was under her name because that was her contract.
Right.
So I think she may be the only writer who was surprised when she saw her show on TV and didn't know who the killer was, and it's something that she, you know, had her name on as being the writer.
Yes.
So we paid a lot of attention to make sure that the stories, even though people remember the comedy bits, I think it was the actual structure that held the show together.
Oh, yes, for sure. For sure. What extraordinary discovery have you found in your life?
When I first started working in TV, I was very impressed that people could work so hard on something. And, you know, like a set designer building a great set, and then the show gets canceled after four episodes, and all of his drawings and all of his work is gone.
Mm-hmm.
And the next day, that artist is up and on to the next thing. Yeah. That kind of recovery, that kind of, he wasn't phoning it in. I mean, all these people are not phoning it in. They're doing great work. They're doing work they could really be proud of. And then when it disappears, there's no, you know, shedding of tears, or, you know, yeah, renting of clothes, or being acrimonious for the next 6 months because, yeah, you were treated unfairly or this didn't work out. It's like, okay, it's fulfilled itself. I'm on to the next thing. And that really amazed me that people could be so dedicated. And
yes,
then if something fails, then they go on to the next thing right away. And to me, that was like a life lesson.
It is a life lesson for whatever you're doing. And it really shows strength of character, because it's so easy to become discouraged and just say, I'm not doing this anymore. Like, this is, BS, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's great testament of character that people can just cut that off and say, okay, now we're going to do this, and we just have to leave that alone, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to do, because artists put their whole, the essence of who they are into their work.
Mm-hmm.
They really do.
And that in a way is a reward in itself. The idea of creating something. And even if tens of millions of people see it, terrific. If no one sees it, you still had the experience of doing it, which to me is fulfilling in and of itself.
Oh, yes.
I was working on a project recently, which I won't name, in which every day there were new notes. And I would come up with, notes that seemed incompatible with each other. So I would, work feverishly and then turn in a new draft and then hear no praise at all for what I had done.
No.
But they would have new notes, sometimes contradicting what they told me the week before.
Yeah.
And it got very frustrating. Mm-hmm. But if I thought of it as, I have friends who do Sudoku, who do Wordle, who challenge themselves with crossword puzzles every day. So, it's a couple hours out of the day and they're solving a puzzle. And, and then the next day there's a new puzzle.
Yeah.
So I started to think of it in that sense that, all right, I'm solving this puzzle. Yeah, and people who get Wordle or Sudoku, don't go looking for world acclaim. It's a puzzle that they solve and they get satisfaction out of that work, out of that, creative or discovery process of solving a puzzle every day. So I thought of it like, this is my Wordle of the day. I'm spending, 4 or 5 hours a day.
Yes.
Trying to solve these plot points. And if I get rewarded or if I don't get rewarded or if someone sees it, there is satisfaction in doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's a process. As a human being, it's a process to let go of the outcome.
Yeah.
You're just doing this work and you just have to let go of whatever happens, that happens. However many times they send it back, you're just going to keep at it. And I really like that analogy because we sometimes, people say, well, you have to get out of your own way. Well, there's a perfect example that you do have to set yourself aside, right?
Mm-hmm.
That side of you that wants to be, frustrated and, just want to maybe even give up. And people do give up. So that's a great analogy. This is just a puzzle. it's just a puzzle. And I love the way your brain thinks. I mean, it's fantastic. It's such great teaching for our audience that's interested. It really is. It's life lessons. And we're always learning life lessons. And so I appreciate that. Is there anything that you'd like to talk about that I haven't asked you?
I don't think so. I began writing books of short mysteries, many, many years ago for kids.
Yes.
I think I have 11 or 12 of them out there. I'm now discussing a contract for a new one, which, if it happens during the writer's strike, that'll be nice. It'll keep me occupied. I don't know. I think it's, I think valuing a story is what I do and what I like. And I think we all have regrets.
Oh, yes.
In life, but there's always a new day. And I think not holding on to those regrets I have a lot of friends who will tell me the same story, you know, in groups at parties, tell me the same story about something that happened to them. And and they still get angry, you know, years after it happened. I think letting go leaves your hands free to grab onto something else.
Yes, it does. And I sometimes I think that that story becomes part of their personality, and they can't let it go because they want to tell as many people as possible. I wouldn't know what the reason would be. They'd be different and varied depending on who you're speaking with. But sometimes people live their life in those stories because it makes up their personality.
Mm-hmm. And I actually, some years ago, read a really fascinating kind of autobiography called, I think it's called The Knight of the Gun. Mm-hmm. And it's about this, he was a well-known writer for the New Yorker, and he was a functioning alcoholic and drug addict for years and years. And had vivid memories about the low point in which he showed up at a friend's doorstep, you know, begging for drugs or begging for money. And his friend pulled a gun on him and said, you know, get out of here. I don't want to see you again. So when he was in recovery, he went to the friend and he says, you know, I have this vivid memory of coming up here and you pulling a gun and telling me to get away. And, and that kind of helped change my life. And the friend said, you were the one with the gun. I didn't have the gun. You had the gun. You're remembering this wrong. And the act of memory changes. And every time you remember something, he wound up doing research on how memory works. And every time you remember something, you're not remembering the original, you're remembering the last time you remembered it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are things in which I'm sure I remember vividly that didn't happen quite the way, because I'm remembering the last time I told the story, or I'm remembering the last time that I remembered the story. The mind is incapable of actually flashing back to the event itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have something that you resent or a story that you've told 50 times, it changes because
it does,
because you're remembering the last time you remembered it, which I thought was really a fascinating glimpse into the way the mind works.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, just recently, I went to lunch with a group of ladies, and this one person said to me, "Oh, Rhonda, tell the story about," and I started telling the story, and she was amazed at how much I had filled in the story since she had last heard it. And she really liked the story this time and said that I was a great storyteller. So it depends on what you're telling, right? And of course, I was telling something really funny and had, you know, had everybody in stitches. And I just love that, you know, a performer always loves, you know, when they're appreciated. And, but yeah, isn't that interesting? And what a great plot for a movie or a novel that he was the one with the gun. Like,
it's a little bit like Memento, where he has no memory of like the previous day and has to make markings on himself in order to remember. And the memory can be very malleable. So.
Oh yes. Oh yes, it sure can be. I really enjoyed our conversation. I think that we could talk quite a bit longer. Thank you very much for spending time talking about what you love and what you do and giving an insight to our audience who may have writing in their life right now and wondering you know, the process and all those things. So I really appreciate having you on the show. It was so delightful to listen to you. And yeah, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rhonda. It's been a pleasure.
Theme song for the Rhonda Grant Show is Sun on the Water, composed and performed by my friend John Park Wheeler. This is Rhonda Grant with The Rhonda Grant Show, author of Magical Forces Within, Extraordinary Discoveries in an Ordinary Life, inviting you to look for the magical forces within yourself today and every day.
Thanks for tuning in to The Rhonda Grant Show with your host, Rhonda Grant. If you would like to find out more information about Rhonda and her upcoming guests and the work that she does, go to her website, rhondagrantauthor.com. That's rhondagrantauthor.com.
Digital Audio Health by Cymatrax.